The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're starting with the intention section of Oprah, Oprah on Surviving Betrayal. Oprah speaks to the daughter of Giselle Pellicott. This article is by Oprah Winfrey. Hey, everyone. Thanks for all your wonderful comments this week about experiences that left you feeling uplifted on Broadway and beyond. Beyonce at Coachella, birds in the snow, my whole body smiled reading about your blissful moments. Today, I wanted to speak to you about surviving betrayal. Of all the emotions we have to endure as humans, I think betrayal is the worst because it can strip you of everything you thought you knew, particularly when the perpetrator is someone close to you or whom you trusted or loved. It's happened to me several times, by people I worked with and a family member. Each time, I felt stunned and numbed. That's why I stand in amazement at my guest this week on the Oprah podcast. Caroline Darien is the daughter of Giselle Pellicott, the French woman who was drugged and raped by her husband and at least 70 other men he recruited to rape her. Police were able to identify, arrest, and prosecute 50 of those men because Caroline's father videotaped them all in the act of assaulting her mother. Caroline says of her parents, "I thought that I had a solid, cheerful, protective, and reassuring dad. I thought also that they were happy together." When Caroline's mother told her what her father had done, she recalls everything changed in a second, and she realized that her life would never be the same. The day after she discovered the horrifying news about her mother, Caroline was called to the police station and shown pictures taken from her father's computer of herself, drugged and unconscious. This month, she filed assault charges against her father. He denies the allegations. Her new book is called I'll Never Call Him Dad Again. How do you go forward after a devastating betrayal that strips you of everything you thought you knew? To hear Caroline's story, watch my YouTube interview or listen on Spotify or Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. Then share with us how you got through the worst moment in your own lives. Was it faith, fortitude, or both? Staying in intentions, the next article is Oprah on how art can move you. One minute you are feeling gut-punched, and the next you're laughing out loud. This article is by Oprah Winfrey. Hi, everybody. It's been a while since I did a video speaking to you all, but I had to tell you about this experience this week. I went to see Gypsy on Broadway, starring Audra McDonald, and I did something I haven't done since high school. I saved the tickets to forever remind me of the transcendent experience it was. To watch someone perform at their highest vibration, a performance straight out of the soul bed, it was so stirring. Her soul stirring ours, the audience, and us all having this glorified shared frequency experience. Like she was absolutely tapped into the God source. One minute you're feeling gut-punched, and the next you are laughing out loud. It was an absolute privilege and an honor to watch the best at her best. It was just so inspiring. I couldn't scream loud enough, applaud, stomp my feet hard enough. And days later, I'm telling you, I'm still marveling and in complete awe of how inspiring it is to see someone do that just at the highest level. I walked out of there wanting to do better and be better. That is what great art does. And I know you all have heard me say over the years, we are all seeking the same thing, the fullest, highest expression of ourselves as human beings. And the fact that everyone in that theater got to see Audra McDonald at her highest vibration and share in that frequency, I tell you, I'm still so moved and vibing from it. I left the theater, flew home back to California. I cried all the way to Kansas and across the Rockies. I was so full. Joy Woods, Jordan Tyson, Danny Bernstein, they're all great supporting in that cast. But Audra? They know, and we all knew, Audra was on another level. And I know what they feel. It's a privilege to be on stage with her every night. I was just wondering if any of you have ever had an experience like that, where you see someone, or you're at an event, or you are so inspired by something that it literally fills you up, and you see that person, and you say, oh, that's why you were born. You are doing the thing you were born to do. That's how I felt watching her. And I mean, I'm just in awe, and I want to hear from you if you've had the same experience. I'm keeping my tickets to always remind me, but it's really right here. It's all right here. Can't wait to hear from you. Hope you have a beautiful week and go well. We've moved over to women who start things. Meet the baker who makes cakes explode, literally. Flower shop founder Amira Kassem shares how she's expanding her empire. Spoiler, hello cupcakes. This article is by Sophia Lodato. Amira Kassem is the owner and founder of the iconic bakery Flower Shop, and that's spelled F-L-O-U-R. Even if you don't follow her on social or haven't seen her Disney Plus series, Foodtastic, there's still a good chance you've seen her viral pinata-inspired cakes online, the ones that spill sprinkles and glitter when you cut into them. Now Kassem and the Flower Shop brand are undergoing a new project, Explosion Cupcakes. They're available now both at flowershop.com and goldbelly.com. Here, the entrepreneur tells us all about the history of her brand and her upcoming endeavors. The inspiration. I never thought about baking as a job or career. It was just something I did at home with my mom. In our community, it was her way of spreading joy. Some write cards for people, but my mom would bake for them. Whether it was a nurse's birthday at school, a neighbor's having a hard time, or any celebration for someone. The way people would be so happy with something homemade really resonated with me. When I moved to New York and worked in fashion, I kept baking for people. The skill set and joy I was putting into it started getting better and better, and one day I realized I want to wake up and play with sprinkles for the rest of my life. When I think about it now, it still feels that way. We get to create the centerpiece of someone's celebration and get to be a part of their special day. And you see this pure joy on their faces, especially if you're not expecting sprinkles to fall out of that cake. That, for me, is the most exciting part of what we do. From style to sprinkles. Fashion and baking are seemingly opposite, but when you craft something the way I do, it's not necessarily just baking a cookie or putting a recipe together, it's art. You're using colors, textures, patterns, shapes, just like with fashion. They can be appreciated at the same level. It was so exciting to work with food. I was able to stay in the fashion industry while doing the thing I loved the most, which was cake. I didn't follow any of the rules. I didn't go to culinary school, and I'm not a classically trained pastry chef. I don't know that I could have even gotten a job at a bakery, let alone be the pastry chef for the Met Gala. I just did it my way, stuck to the things I loved and hoped that it would be embraced, and sure enough it was. The hardest part. We're a business, a startup, and there's a lot of struggle that comes with it. I moved to New York not knowing a single person. Learning to say no and understanding that our time was valuable was very difficult. In the beginning, I wanted to do everything. I had a fear that if I turned something down, they wouldn't come back to me. The pandemic was also really hard for most people in this industry, where you're creating something for events and celebrations that, at the time, were just not happening. It was a time to make it or break it, a time to pivot and focus on what we could do and what I loved doing most. We shifted everything to online shipping, and that was a huge struggle. We're talking about shipping 6-layer cakes, carving out the inside, filling them with sprinkles, and then sending them. My husband and I eventually developed this unique packaging insert that allowed us to do it, and it changed our business. The aha moment. Our aha moments are all about celebrating the little things. Honestly, they just keep happening and they don't stop. As long as I get to celebrate the little moments once in a while, both in work and in my life, whether it's a celebrity posting about our cakes or us getting involved in Oprah's favorite things or what have you, that's what brings me joy. I also feel like we're finally getting back into the groove of things. We're a small company, female-founded, Latin-owned, all real ingredients. It's just me, my husband, and a few of our favorite people making it happen. We crack every egg. It's exciting to move past what we had to face during COVID. Why cupcakes? Why now? Personally, I was never that into cupcakes. They just weren't my favorite product. Just because there is a demand for something, you don't have to feed it. It has to be a demand for something you're excited about. Could I have been selling cupcakes 10 years ago? 5 years ago? 100%. But it wasn't right. I didn't want them at the time. It wasn't until I had kids that I realized why I was getting so many messages about including cupcakes in our shop. I saw my own kids get so excited when their friends brought cupcakes to school and at parties, and realized that it's so much easier for parents to dole them out. I ended up bringing them to my daughter's school for Valentine's Day, and everyone freaked out. Now it feels like the right moment to introduce them to the brand. I get it, and I'm excited to give it to my kids. Advice for aspiring bakers? I've always heard advice like, look at your competitors, look at what people are doing, and see what works for them. For me, it's been the complete opposite. I don't want to know what works for someone else. I want to come up with my own ideas and have things feel organic to me. We have collections with Williams Sonoma, with Pottery Barn. We have shoes, we have luggage, we have tutus. And every single one of those launches has been me going with my gut. Me saying, this product makes me happy. Going with your gut and not paying attention to what everyone else is doing is really important. Think of yourself as an artist and creator first, and a business person second. It's so much more exciting to put forth something that works for and is unique to you. There's a book that accompanies this article, The Power of Sprinkles by Amira, and that's A-M-I-R-H, Kassem, K-A-S-S-E-M. It's $15 right now at Amazon. We're heading over to wellness now. What not to say to someone with a chronic illness, and some helpful things to offer instead. This article is by Amy Kurtz, as told to Jesse Van Amberg. I remember the exact moment when my entire life changed. I was 14 years old and had just come home from dance class. I bent down to pick up my math textbook off the floor when a shooting pain exploded up my spine. I had never felt anything like it, and that pain stayed with me for years. My parents took me to dozens of the best doctors, and none of them could figure out what was wrong with me. Instead, I was put on anti-inflammatories to help ease the pain and was expected to adjust to a new version of me. I adapted and tried to live as normal a life as possible, switching from dance and sports to theater, going with friends to parties, and trying to act as if I weren't in pain all the time. I was able to cope with this new normal until I got very ill during a trip to Israel when I was 25. A tidal wave of symptoms hit me all at once. My weight ballooned. I couldn't keep food down. My hair started falling out. I couldn't go to the bathroom, and I couldn't catch my breath. Something was very wrong. I had to move back in with my parents in Philadelphia to recuperate and get to the bottom of what was going wrong. Over the next 10 years, I spent most of my time seeing every single specialist under the sun. Finally, 4 years ago, Dr. Number 36 figured it out. He told me, "You have late-stage Lyme disease, which is when untreated Lyme bacteria spreads to the rest of the body." I also learned I had 2 co-infections and a slow thyroid. I was overwhelmed with so many emotions: gratitude for the diagnosis, pride in myself for never giving up on finding answers, and for being strong enough to listen to my instincts when I knew something was still wrong. So much grief because I had struggled for so long in the dark. I was sick for over 2 decades, and now I am finally in the final stages of healing. I've learned from my own experience and that of my clients that having a chronic illness shifts the axis on which everything in your life functions, including your relationships with loved ones. There's no road map for how to adjust to this new unspoken territory. In trying to be there for me, people in my life have made a lot of inadvertent missteps and said things that didn't help at all. No matter how well-intentioned, these statements caused me a lot of pain and frustration. No one is to blame here. There's no set way to handle this new reality. Yet, considering that 6 in 10 Americans has at least one kind of chronic health condition, yes, you read that right, we need to think differently about how we talk about this. I share these unhelpful statements with you so that you can be more mindful in your own relationships with loved ones living with chronic health conditions. Number 1. You don't look sick. People assume you should be in bed or look bad if you don't feel well, or that you should look or act a certain way. That's just not true in my experience. Some days I may seem fine, and other days I've been so exhausted I can barely move. Despite how much more awareness there is about invisible conditions such as Lyme disease, Crohn's disease, or rheumatoid arthritis, some people still have this mindset that you need to look sick to truly be ill. So this is so invalidating to what I and so many others experience. It makes us feel as if our pain isn't taken seriously just because we happen to be able to put on shoes and go outside today. Number 2, have you tried this? I can't tell you how many times I have talked to someone about my health, and they immediately chime in with, "Well, I talked to Betsy's son, cousin's girlfriend, and she said that this herb works. You should try it." I know these suggestions are meant to be helpful, but trust me, I have tried everything. I've seen 36 doctors, gone to acupuncture, taken herbs, been on lots of different medications. Odds are your loved one with chronic illness has too. The last thing they need is more random input, no matter how kindly meant. Number 3, are you feeling any better? This is another question that is intended to be supportive, but I also find it so impersonal. Same goes for, is anything working? It reduces what I have gone through to mere physical symptoms, rather than acknowledging the enormous gravity that chronic illness can have on someone's entire life. Their emotions, their spirit, their well-being, everything. Again, I know the question is well-intentioned, but it could land anywhere between tone-deaf and insulting. Number 4, you just need a Xanax. Yes, this is a real thing. A doctor told me once in response to my sharing details about my very real physical symptoms. It's akin to, it's all in your head, as if anxiety alone could cause me so much physical pain, exhaustion, joint pain, and GI distress. Even if other individuals in my life haven't been so blunt, I'm sure there are plenty of people who question how real my symptoms are. I've realized over the years that chronic illness, or illness in general, brings up a lot of feelings in others. More on that below. Number 5, that's not possible. I understand that my health journey might seem long and improbable, or that my symptoms might not make sense. I struggled for decades to understand how unexplained childhood back pain could possibly relate to my hair falling out, terrible gut issues, constant fatigue, and mysterious weight gain. But it's not okay to immediately respond to my experience or anyone else's with flat-out denial, dismissal, or condescension. Number 6, I just can't count on you anymore. This one really hurts. I wish I were well enough to always show up for my loved ones. I hate that I can no longer go to every birthday party, bachelorette trip, or happy hour hangout, but sometimes I just can't. People will say, oh, she's flaky, or she can't follow through, and that's so painful. I do my best, and certainly did in the depth of my struggling, and I know it's not always enough. I just wish people were more understanding and willing to meet me where I am, or when I was at my worst. If I could, I would. Number 7, radio silence. People tend to be uncomfortable with what they don't understand, including a chronic illness. And then they just don't say anything or stop reaching out. I know people might not know what to say or are dealing with their own fears and worries, but for the person who is not well, that silence feels very isolating and lonely. Try this instead. When I was struggling, what I most needed from my friends and family was validation and support. Navigating a chronic illness can be so hard and so lonely, and it's even worse when those closest to you seem to doubt your experiences or pull away. Instead, the simplest way to be supportive is to just listen and show empathy. Hearing someone say, "I'm sorry that this has been so painful," or "You have suffered so much," really means a lot. Asking questions about a person's experience, like, "What does it feel like to go through this?" also helps show how much you care about the person without inadvertently reducing them to their condition or symptoms. Offering a hand proactively is always appreciated, too. That could look like bringing over dinner during a flare-up, offering to drive to the next doctor's appointment, or just asking what the person needs in order to feel supported. It shows a willingness to be a part of the experience with your loved one. One of the hardest parts about navigating a chronic health condition is feeling as if you are totally alone. It's like you're in a completely different world from everyone else. Having friends and family strong enough to stand with you helps make the experience a lot less lonely. Amy Kurtz is a patient advocate and health coach and the author of the book Kicking Sick, Your Go-To Guide for Thriving with Chronic Health Conditions. Her next book, But You Look Fine, Trapped in the Hell Between Sick and Well, and How to Break Free, will be published by Balance Hatchet in 2026. Amy has been featured on Good Morning America and Fox and in NY Mag. This is another article in Wellness. What's your burial type? Sure, there are caskets and cremation, but did you know about composting and green burials? Here's a primer because it never hurts to plan ahead. This article is by Suzanne B. O'Brien, RN. Letting go of our loved ones is never easy, and during times of grief, it can be especially hard to make sound financial decisions while planning a funeral and burial. I recall meeting a woman in Florida who shared how her family had experienced this firsthand when they needed to arrange their father's burial after his death. They were so disoriented by the sudden loss that they ended up splurging on a deluxe casket, extravagant floral arrangements, and even an insurance policy against the casket breaking down. These were all expenses that would have gone against every fiber of the frugal man's being while he was alive. Obviously, not planning ahead can have substantial consequences for us, both emotionally and financially. Luckily, there are many progressive options for body disposition today. Each method has its own unique set of pros and cons, so it's important to weigh them all carefully before deciding how to proceed. Let's explore what's available. Standard funeral. A standard funeral typically includes several key components, including embalming of the body, viewing or visitation, a funeral ceremony or service, and burial in a cemetery. Pros: readily available in most places. Cons: embalming fluids containing a mixture of chemicals such as formaldehyde, glutaraldehyde, and phenol, which can be harmful to the environment when released into the soil during burial. These chemicals can also pose health risks to funeral home workers who handle them frequently. Traditional burials often involve the use of concrete vaults or liners that are designed to prevent the ground from sinking over time. However, these structures can also prevent natural decomposition and create issues with water runoff. Cost? The cost of a standard funeral can vary widely, depending on a number of factors, such as the location, the funeral home or service provider chosen, and the specific services requested. The average cost of a traditional funeral in the United States is $7,000 to $12,000. Green/natural burial. Typically, the body is wrapped in a biodegradable shroud or placed in a simple wooden casket made from sustainable harvested wood. The grave itself may be left unmarked or marked with natural materials such as stones or plants rather than traditional headstones. These green burials take place in dedicated green cemeteries that are specifically designed for this purpose. Pros: Green/natural burials allow the body to decompose naturally and return to the earth without the use of harmful chemicals or non-biodegradable materials, reducing the environmental impact associated with traditional burial practices. Green cemeteries used for natural burials often serve as protected areas for native flora and fauna, preserving valuable green spaces for future generations. Some people find that a natural burial offers a more meaningful and personal way to say goodbye to their loved one, as it allows for a closer connection with nature and a sense of returning to the earth. Cons: not all areas have access to green burial options, so it may not be feasible or practical for everyone. Visit the Green Burial Council to see what's available near you. Additionally, some religious beliefs require specific types of burial practices that may not align with natural burial principles. Cost: these methods are usually less expensive with traditional funerals, as they often involve fewer costly materials and services. The costs vary widely, however, depending on the specific choices made. Fire cremation. Fire cremation is an increasingly popular alternative to traditional burial. The body is placed in a special chamber and exposed to high temperatures that reduce it to ash. The ashes can then be kept in a container or scattered. Check your location for specific laws, but in general in the U.S., we cannot scatter ashes in a public park without a permit. The Federal Clean Water Act requires that the Environmental Protection Agency be notified before scattering ashes, and if in the ocean, they must be scattered at least 3 nautical miles out to sea. For lakes and rivers, a permit is usually required from the local government. Ashes can be scattered from the air, but not while still in a container. Pros: more economical than standard burial, and it grants families flexibility in terms of where ashes may be scattered or stored, while providing convenient transport options during funerals or memorials. Cons: the process of burning the body releases pollutants into the atmosphere, such as carbon dioxide, nitrogen, oxides, and other toxic gases. Fire cremation also emits toxic emissions from mercury or silver dental fillings. These gases and emissions can contribute to air pollution and are thought to be linked to respiratory illnesses such as chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD. Cost: the average cost of a cremation in the United States is generally less than a traditional funeral. According to the National Funeral Directors Association, the median cost with a memorial service in 2019 was about $5,150. But this figure can vary widely depending on location, type of urn selected, and additional services. A direct cremation, which does not involve a viewing or ceremony, can cost as little as $500 in some areas. Water/aqua cremations. Water cremation, also known as aquamation or alkaline hydrolysis, is a new alternative to traditional cremation that involves using water and alkaline chemicals to break down the body. The process is usually carried out in a stainless steel chamber where the body is placed along with water and potassium hydroxide or sodium hydroxide, which dissolves the tissue over several hours. Pros: a water cremation uses 90% less energy and produces 10 times fewer carbon dioxide emissions than a fire cremation. It produces no carbon dioxide or metal emissions. The liquid byproduct is a non-toxic solution of amino acids, peptides, sugars, and soap, which make a wonderful fertilizer. Families can even take it home to water trees and plants in their personal garden. Cons: water cremations aren't legal in every U.S. state yet. As of September 2022, they are legal in the following states: Arizona, California, Colorado, Florida, Georgia, Idaho, Illinois, Kansas, Maine, Maryland, Michigan, Minnesota, Missouri, Nevada, New Hampshire, Oregon, Pennsylvania, and Utah. Cost $2,000 to $3,000. Human composting. Also known as natural organic reduction, human composting is a process that involves converting human remains into soil. It usually means placing the body in a vessel with wood chips, straw, or other organic materials and maintaining it at a specific temperature and moisture level over several weeks to allow for natural decomposition. Microbes break down the body into its basic components, including carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus. After the process is complete, what's left is a nutrient-rich soil that can be used for gardening or other purposes. Pros: human composting is a more environmentally sustainable alternative to traditional burial or cremation. It involves no chemicals and it requires less energy than cremation. Cons: currently, human composting is legal only in the states of Colorado, Oregon, and Washington, as well as in the country of Sweden. However, interest in this method is growing, so more states and countries may consider legalizing it in the future. Cost: $5,000 to $7,000. Body donation. Also known as whole body donation, this involves donating the body to medical schools, research facilities, or other organizations for medical research and education. Advance arrangements with a specific organization or institution are required. The organization then arranges to transport the body to their facility. As a thank you, many medical schools will hold a memorial service of gratitude for families and loved ones of the deceased. After the research has been completed, the medical facility cremates the remains and returns the ashes to the family. Pros: some people feel that their death is more meaningful because it will provide a valuable contribution to medicine. Cons: not all bodies are accepted for donation. Factors such as age, cause of death, and medical conditions may disqualify someone from becoming a donor. Make sure to find a reputable place for donation. Not all places are equal and may falsely advertise. If you aren't sure, ask doctors and hospitals for advice. In the U.S., you can search for reputable programs at https://anatb.acb.med.ufl.edu. It's also important to discuss this decision with family members so that they understand and support it. Cost: free. Once accepted, there is no cost for the donation process, cremation, or return of final remains. There's a book that accompanies this article. It's called The Good Death, a guide for supporting your loved one through the end of life. It's $26 at Amazon and $26 at Walmart. We're over in books. 5 gardening books that'll make your spring bloom. Whether you're looking for a down and dirty how-to guide or an art book that brings spring into your house without getting dirt under your nails, we've got you covered. This article is by Charlie Burlock. No, it's not a mirage. The first blooms of spring have arrived. It's time to get your garden in order. While your insultingly type A neighbor may have you feeling like you're already behind, the Sweet Pea School will teach you that, depending on your USDA zone, you could be right on schedule to have your lawn bursting with even the most, allegedly, finicky flower in no time. If the term USDA zone alone has you breaking out in sweats, chill out. Martha Stewart's Gardening Handbook and Amber Grossman's Black Girls Gardening will have you speaking native garden talk after 3 pages. You're in good hands. Time to get them dirty. The Sweet Pea School by Marin Mathis. That's M-A-R-R-Y-N. If you've ever wrapped your finger around their green curlicue tendrils, caught a whiff of their delightfully delicate fragrance, or spotted a field blushing bright with their tall, tangled stalks, then you know the magic of sweet peas. What you might not know is that you can have that magic in your own backyard, regardless of your skill or its size. Dispelling the persistent myths that the genus requires a restrictive excess of time and space, Mathis guides readers through the process, history, and abundant payoffs of cultivating the Sicilian native, who knew, plants. The Washington-based flower farmer's own story offers ample inspiration, though she now boasts the title Sweet Pea Queen, and 20,000 of plants to match. She only discovered her passion for planting later in life, after more than 2 decades in it. Though her advice is accessible and comprehensive, her flowers, captured in brilliant color and dazzling detail on every page, steal the show. If you don't have sweet peas in your garden yet, having this book on your coffee table is the next best thing. The book is called Sweet Pea School, and it's $24 at Amazon. Black Girls Gardening by Amber Grossman. From the green-thumbed sensation behind the popular @BlackGirlsGardening Instagram account comes a collection of short essays from black and mixed black women offering personal details and insightful tips intended to help you reconnect with your birthright, the powerful autonomy of connecting with the land. Between these intimate and inspirational stories, Grossman includes no-nonsense advice to help you initiate or deepen your own gardening practice, from selecting the right tools to attracting the right pollinators to beginning your composting practice. It can be easier and less smelly than you think. Arranged into themed sections on gardening with kids, growing for the kitchen, and community farming, this book provides both the inspiration and instruction to join the ranks of the badass trowel-wielding women featured in its pages. Martha Stewart's Gardening Handbook by Martha Stewart. In her first gardening book in over 30 years, the indisputable champion of the domestic arts strikes her signature balance of aspiration and application, pairing drool-inducing photos of mandalas shaved into pine-shrouded lawns and arbors bursting with climbing hydrangeas, along with practical guidance for every gardening budget and experience level. With easy-to-follow glossaries and graphs, you actually want to look at this book, teaches you how to plant for location, aesthetic taste, and lifestyle. Can you really keep up with the pruning schedule of a wisteria vine? Whether you dream of growing your own groceries and bouquets, building an eco-friendly sanctuary for native flora and fauna, or transforming your dusty apartment balcony into a flowering oasis, Stewart leads you through every step of the process. From idea to implementation to iterative delight, Martha Stewart's Gardening Handbook by Martha Stewart It's $28 at Amazon and $28 at Walmart. Living with Flowers by Aaron Lauder. Who said that spring's bounty could only be enjoyed outside? In this lush photo book, tea-style icon and businesswoman Erin Lauder takes readers on a tour of her homes and the florals that fill them, from fragrances to prints to the plants themselves. Each page is a visual bouquet of ephemeral arrangements and timeless taste. Ringlets of purple Japanese sweet pea vines curling out of antique silver, blazes of Icelandic poppies against dark polished wood, seafoam silk wallpaper hand-painted with blooming vines. Alongside the botanical eye candy, Lauder reflects on how flowers have influenced her life and the life of her grandmother, Estee, yes, that's Estee Lauder. The book also includes a charming glossary of flower symbolism and quotes from acclaimed florists, event planners, and designers on how to grow a life alongside petals and perennials. Living with Flowers by Erin, and that's spelled A-E-R-I-N, Lauder, L-A-U-D-E-R, is $34 at Amazon and $34 at Target. Love Letter to a Garden by Debbie Millman. A collaboration between Debbie Millman, an award-winning artist, designer, and the host of the podcast Design Matters, and her wife, best-selling author Roxane Gay. Talk about a power couple. This book is a poignant visual ode to the natural world's power to sustain, inspire, and regenerate. A native New Yorker, Millman's gardening experience began with planting apple seeds with her grandmother in the Staten Island soil. Through photos, painting, words, and collages, she documents her lifelong quest for a garden of her own and the life lessons she reaped with her fingers in the dirt. Following Millman's artistic reflections on her ongoing horticulture education, Gay offers her original recipes sourced from and inspired by her wife's bounty. While there are plenty of gardening books that teach you how to irrigate a raised bed or identify an aphid infestation, there is no other book like this. Love Letter to a Garden by Debbie Millman is $19 at Amazon. Over in culture and news and books, get your tickets to see Gail King and Tina Knowles discuss Matriarch. Our editor-at-large will join Michelle Obama as a moderator on the Matriarch book tour. This article is by Charlie Burlock. In a little over a month, Matriarch, a memoir, will be hitting shelves. Tina Knowles' highly anticipated book in which she opens up about everything from her childhood in Texas to how she became the ultimate musical matriarch to daughters Beyoncé and Solange. Yesterday, on Instagram, Knowles shared the schedule for her first ever book tour, which will begin in Washington, D.C., with a conversation moderated by former First Lady Michelle Obama. While yesterday's posts kept us in the dark as to who would be joining her on the other eight stops, today we get to share that our very own editor-at-large, Gail King, will be the moderator for Knowles' May 19 event at the Brooklyn Paramount. While Knowles is best known as the mother of two cultural icons in her aptly titled debut memoir, she is finally telling her own story, from her upbringing in Galveston, Texas, to her time on the road with Destiny's Child, to watching her superstar children take flight on the global stage. While we have to wait until April 22nd to get our hands on a copy, we already know that the book will give Gail and Miss Tina plenty to discuss. Tickets went on sale March 21st and are found on Ticketmaster. It also has the events listed. April 30th, Washington, D.C., moderated by Mrs. Michelle Obama. May 2nd, Los Angeles, California, moderated by Miss Kiki Palmer. May 5th, Houston, Texas, moderated by Mrs. Kelly Rowland. May 8th, Atlanta, Georgia, moderated by Mr. Tyler Perry. May 10th, New Orleans, moderated by Mrs. Tamron Hall. May 12th, Toronto, moderated by CNN's Mrs. Abby Philip. May 16th, Chicago, CNN's Mrs. Laura Coates. May 19th, Brooklyn, moderated by Ms. Gail King. And June 4th, London, moderator to be announced. Parts of this article were edited due to time. Our next article is over in Wellness. This is your brain on grief. When you lose someone, a neurological rewiring kicks in to help you through the shock and heartache. This article is by Claire Bidwell Smith, LCPC. According to brain scientists, grieving is actually a form of learning. Our grief is teaching us how to be in the world without our person. When we experience a loss, our brains begin working overtime, forming new habits for the new world in which we live, reconfiguring associations we had connected to our person, rearranging our attachments, and determining new ways for us to interact. Studies show that grief is tied to many different brain functions, from memory recall to our attunement to those around us. Grief is also connected to brain functioning that affects our heart rate and our sensations of pain and suffering. When we experience a significant loss, the brain perceives it as a threat to survival, and it employs defense mechanisms that increase blood pressure and heart rate and even release specific hormones. Many of us undergo changes in memory, sleep, heart function, and immune response, and experience cognitive effects like brain fog. Essentially, the brain kicks into survival mode. Science also demonstrates that the process of grieving is an evolutionary adaptation to promote survival in the face of trauma. When we experience trauma, our brain creates connections between nerves, and it strengthens or weakens existing connections depending on the intensity of our emotional response. This ability to alter neural pathways is referred to as neuroplasticity, and it allows the brain to compensate for life-altering events like injury, illness, and loss by forming new neural connections based on these experiences, in essence, making it possible for us to adapt to new situations or circumstances. When our brains undergo so much neurological rewiring, our thought patterns can also become disrupted. You may find yourself surprised or even alarmed by some of the strange thoughts you are having. It may help to know just how normal and common they really are. What if thinking? In her famed Five Stages of Grief, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross wrote about the bargaining process a dying person goes through when they are facing the end of their life. They may bargain with the doctors, themselves, and their higher powers. When this stage of bargaining is translated to the grief process, it most often takes the shape of what-if thoughts. You find yourself preoccupied with what-if scenarios. You may find that the last few months, weeks, days, and even minutes of your loved one's life have taken on great meaning. What if they had chosen a different treatment? What if you had called another doctor? What if you had turned left instead of right? What if you had said yes instead of no? This is a natural response to losing someone you love. Your brain is turning the sequence of events around and around like a Rubik's Cube, attempting to solve for a different outcome. Your brain is attempting to find a scenario that would lead to your person still being here. This is your heart's way of pleading for them not to be gone. This is you wanting them back. This is normal. This is okay. This kind of thinking will ease in time. Magical thinking. Magical thinking is the belief that our thoughts or words have the power to cause events and outcomes. This is a common occurrence in children ages 2 to 7 who have not yet grasped how their thoughts and wishes have little effect on what happens in real life. This kind of thinking translates to a grieving person believing that their thoughts and wishes should have prevented an outcome, or that their thoughts and actions could have caused an outcome. I was thinking as young children think, as if my thoughts or wishes had the power to reverse the narrative. Joan Didion. When you find yourself cycling through this kind of magical thinking, you may realize that you are paying more attention to details that support your beliefs and leaving out evidence that would remind you that you did not have control over the outcome. It can be helpful to ask yourself two questions. What were my intentions? Did I make the best choice given the knowledge I had at the time? Yearning. This arises when we feel an ongoing and sometimes painful desire to be reunited with our person. Our focus shifts entirely to what it would be like to be together again. You may find yourself yearning for them at certain times in your life together, perhaps many years ago or more recently. You may yearn to be with them even during times when things were hard or when they were very sick. Your heart may ache, and you feel preoccupied with only thoughts of what it would be like to be together. These feelings are normal, if not frustrating and sometimes uncomfortable. The yearning is a way of feeling close to them, and it will persist for different periods of time for each of us. Rumination. Sometimes in grief we find ourselves focusing on one aspect of a person's life or death in an obsessive manner. This is commonly referred to as looping or ruminating. Sometimes we are doing this as a way of trying to understand what has happened, trying to know the unknowable. Sometimes this rumination is a result of a traumatic event, or it is linked to feelings of guilt or yearning. In the short term, rumination is a normal experience, and it eventually gives way to new understandings about our loss. But sometimes we can get stuck in these looping thoughts, which can lead to a prolonged feeling of distress. Modalities like EMDR or CBT, or even just doing some simple processing and talk therapy, can help us get out of a loop. Remind yourself that these thoughts are a normal part of grief. Remind yourself that some of these thoughts are not based in fact, and search for evidence that supports a more positive way of thinking. If these thoughts are interrupting your sleep, try getting up and writing them down as a way to release them before returning to bed. Usually, there is a reason for the rumination. Something has been left undone or unsaid, a trauma has occurred, or there's not enough information available with which to come to an understanding about an event. Addressing these blocks is the way to move forward. Intrusive thoughts. Some of us may experience unwanted thoughts and images that seem to come up out of nowhere at random moments. This can be unsettling, but is not uncommon. Intrusive thoughts are spurred by anxiety and are typically a result of having experienced some trauma surrounding your loss. You may find yourself experiencing recurrent imagery about your loved one's death or last moments. This is your brain's way of trying to comprehend and process the experience. The brain triggers these intrusive thoughts as a chemical response to the mind's fear response to the event. The imagery you experience may come in the form of visual experience. Similar to rumination, intrusive thoughts may require additional support in order to overcome them. Techniques like EMDR and CBT are helpful. Although intrusive thoughts can be frightening to experience, remind yourself that you are safe and seek help to break the occurrences. Dreams. Many people experience a vast array of dreams about the person they have lost. Some may be distressing and others comforting. Some people do not dream of their loved ones, even though they wish they could. Often these dreams can be a helpful part of the grief process, even when the dreams are distressing. Your mind is attempting to integrate your loss, even when you are unconscious. Journaling about your dreams or processing them with a therapist can aid in a deeper understanding of what your dreams are asking you to examine so that you may better heal. All of these shifts in perspective might sound like a lot, but perhaps there is comfort to be found in knowing that your brain is growing in order to support your grief process. Let this fact serve as a reminder that you innately know how to grieve. Allow yourself to stop resisting and be present to your experience. Even when you think you don't know what to do, there are parts of you that do. There's a book that accompanies this article, Conscious Grieving, A Transformative Approach to Healing from Loss. It's $11 at Amazon and $9 at Walmart. Under Hotels We Love, Amanyara, Turks, and Caicos. Designed with tranquility and privacy in mind, this luxury wellness resort is the perfect place to relax and restore. This article is by Michael McCormick. I didn't realize how much I needed a reprieve from an especially busy and cold New York winter, or the freshly blended pineapple juice cocktail I was handed upon arrival. Our view of the beach at golden hour, which nearly had me in tears. This recently refurbished luxurious sanctuary on an 18,000-acre nature reserve on the northwestern edge of Providenciales delivers a unique wellness experience designed with guest comfort and privacy as its top priorities. As an art director, the look and feel of a travel destination for me is as important as the food, service, and amenities they provide. I need a little pretty scenery to recharge both my creative and physical batteries. This luxurious property was just what I was seeking. Upon entry, you are immediately drawn into spare yet lush landscaping and three gorgeous structures. The bar, the entrance pavilion, and the restaurant, which all seem to float around a central tranquil pond. The bar, a circular breezy common space with comfy bar chairs and plush booths, which frankly are really just beds to laze around in while you enjoy the scene, is the heart of the property. Let's just say I drank more than a few perfect balanced sacchettinis at sunset crafted by expert mixologists during my stay. And while Amanyara is obviously gorgeous when the sun is shining, it is beyond stunning at night as the reflections of the architectural elements and lighting dance off the surfaces of the pools. Parts of this article were edited due to time. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.